passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me is my colleague Peter Flaherty, and we're here to talk Caitlin Clark.
I wish. She went off
the best.
Are like 30 seconds of basketball talk in the coldest take of the century. Caitlin Clark is insane. I'm obviously pulling for her to win a national title, and it's going to be must watch tomorrow.
Yeah, it's. I wish that they did not play the women's Final Four on Friday night, because we're going to have some dual screen action going on. Fortunately, though, this week, Peter, I got to say it, like, we got to call it like it is. This week's not a great week of college baseball. So if you're looking for a week to, like, go out and mow the lawn or do whatever you got to do, not be quite so locked in on Saturday and Sunday, like, this is probably the week to do it. As such, we're going to spend some time on this podcast talking about some things that we haven't gotten enough. There are some teams, there's some conferences that we have not spent enough time on here on the podcast. That's not to say we're going to ignore the fact that, like, LSU swept Arkansas last weekend, or Arkansas swept LSU, excuse me.
That would have been something.
That really would have been something. we'll touch on that. We'll touch on a lot of, you know, some of the bigger items from last week. But I do want to, we spend a lot of time talking ACC and SEC. But Peter, I wanted to talk Big 12 today. I have, in the last 2 weeks, started our weekly Field of 64 projections over at baseballamerica.com. You can find them there. And I was going through this week's, you know, looking at the at-large candidates, as I do every week once I start doing this. And the Big 12 really fascinated me. Early in the year, I was just kind of like, what is this conference? Like, you know, once TCU got punched in the face at the start of conference play, I was like, this team doesn't even have, or this conference doesn't have an elite team. Like, is this just going to be like it was last year, where they kind of muddle through it and somebody has to host and, you know, there we go. But I'm more excited about this conference now, a month on from the start of conference play. And part of that is because there is no elite team, but every team basically is good. Like, you can write off a couple of teams at the bottom of the conference, but honestly, like, 10, 11 teams in this conference are really good. They're not all going to get into the tournament. It's not quite that deep, but I put 8 teams into the field this week, which would match, that'd be the highest for the Big 12 since 2009. And I think it's, would match their highest ever. So it's an exciting conference. It's a weird conference. And part of the weirdness is that we don't have anyone in the Big 12 ranked in the top 25 right now. And Peter, that is the first time that's ever happened. They've been ranking teams at Baseball America since 1981. We have never gone a week without a team from the Big 12, or the Big 8, as it used to be known, not in the top 25. It's strange. It's a byproduct of a lot of things, but I just want to kind of embrace the weirdness that is Big 12 baseball right now. And the conference just feels totally wide open to me.
Yeah, 100%. And outside of really just a couple teams or a few teams that are cellar dwelling right now, everyone is extremely competitive. I think any team could beat any other on a given weekend. And I think that's what will make it and has made it so much fun to follow so far, because it has been really tough to get a read on. And I think that the narrative early on, at least through the midway point of the season, has been that the Big 12 is, I don't know about down being the right word, but it's obviously a mess. There might not be a top dog, but I think now At least for me, it's more about the depth of the conference, how many good teams there actually are. Like Kansas is sitting there right near the top of the conference. UCF in its first year is at 500 and playing really good baseball. And then you have the usual suspects like Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas State at the top right now, and Oklahoma State lurking. So like there is every weekend going forward is there are drastic implications for the conference standings.
So if you look at the conference standings, Oklahoma is at the top. And last week, the last 2 weeks, Oklahoma had been in the top 25. They're out now because they got swept at home last weekend by Lamar. Oklahoma is 16-12 overall, 7-2 in conference. So that means they're 9-10 in non-conference play, which is, I mean, this is part of the reason why the conference lacks an elite team and lacks a spot in the top 25 right now, is that there's a lot of that going on in the league. Nothing quite that breathtaking, but for Oklahoma, that was a killer sweep. You know, that this was a team that had been playing really good baseball, and but now over the last 2 weeks, they had a homestand, an 8-game homestand in which they went 2-6. They lost a home series to West Virginia, and then they got swept by Lamar. The two wins were shutouts, including a no-hitter they threw against West Virginia. It's just, outside of those two shutouts, they allowed a ton of runs. And I kind of all season have struggled to get a feel for Oklahoma. Peter, you've been a little more bullish on them, but the dichotomy of Oklahoma, like Oklahoma at its best, incredibly good. They swept TCU in Fort Worth a couple of weeks ago. Oklahoma at its worst, though, clearly, I mean, Lamar is a good team. They're the Southland favorites. They're, you know, they are like 21-4 or something this year. Like they are a really good team in their own right, but they're not a team that you would expect to sweep the Big 12 leaders on the road. So this up and downness of Oklahoma, there's still time to get it ironed out in the second half, but they really have to find some more consistency if they're going to, if they're going to reach their ceiling, any of that, they've got to find some real consistency.
Yeah, the past couple weeks, it's really been the duality of Oklahoma. You mentioned they go out and throw a no-hitter, and they look really good against a solid West Virginia team. And then they go and get swept by Lamar. And similar to you, I want to give Lamar its flowers. Like, they're sitting at 23-5. They are the top dogs and the favorites to win the Southland. They're a really good team. But also, that's not a team that Oklahoma should be getting swept and really kind of dominated by at home. And I still am a fan of Oklahoma. They have a lot of nice pieces. They have a couple on offense, Jackson Nicklaus and Easton Carmichael, along with Bryce Madrone, Michael Snyder, John Spikerman is a really good player. Like, there are 5 to 6 hitters in that lineup that I really like. And then on the mound, Kyson Witherspoon has been outstanding. He started off as a reliever, late inning guy. He has been elongated recently and most recently has made the jump to the rotation. Braden Davis is better than his somewhat inflated ERA might suggest. So that's a really good 1-2 punch in the rotation. And they throw the ball reasonably well. Jace Minor has thrown it well recently. Brennan Gurton, Texas Tech transfer. There are a lot of quality pieces. Like you said, they have to have some level of consistency if they want to, you know, make any run at all and potentially get itself back into the hosting picture.
They made 8 errors over the weekend. Obviously that is contributing to getting swept. 8 errors in 3 games is not going to get it done no matter who you're playing. They played much better on Tuesday. They beat Wichita State on the road. And like, that is just kind of Oklahoma this year is 9-8 at home and 5-1 on the road. That road mark goes to 7-4 if you include neutral site games. But the fact that they are a better team away from home than they are at home right now makes them like completely strange in this year's college baseball, where the cheat code is playing at home, it seems like. So we'll see where Oklahoma can go from here, but I still feel good about them going forward. Just they are now, it's hard to say that, you know, they're head and shoulders above the rest of the conference. This weekend, they're playing Oklahoma State. We're going to get into that series in a little more detail here in a second, but Oklahoma State is who I gave the hosting spot to in this week's Field of 64. The Big 12 is not required to have a host. It's not like there's a carve out for the Big 12, but last year the committee carved out a spot for the Big 12, and I think they will again, even if some of the RPIs don't end up quite in a situation where you would expect a typical host to be. It's too early to really worry about that. I'm just kind of assuming that the Big 12, somebody will emerge. And the last couple weeks, Oklahoma State has played quite well. They won a series against TCU. They went on the road and won a series against West Virginia. This is a team we ranked coming into the season. They had some tough times in there, but they've been healthier. They've been scoring more runs, which has been those two things go together. Nolan Schubert getting healthy has really helped them. And I'm encouraged about the trend line on Oklahoma State.
Yeah, and I think that they've flown a little bit under the radar just due to their slowish start. But in kind of reverse Oklahoma State fashion, they are a team that is built on its pitching. Like, their pitching staff is their biggest strength by far. They have a team ERA under 3.5. Brian Holiday and Sam Garcia, that is a legitimate 1-2 punch in the front of the rotation, and an imposing one at that, especially Brian Holiday, who this year has a 1.75 ERA with 56 Ks to just 8 walks across 51 and a third innings. Sam Garcia gives you a different look from the left side, and then they have Jansen Kiesel, who attacks you from that extremely low release height. He's got a unicorn fastball. He's been deployed in a Sunday role, midweek role. They've moved him around some, and then you have Robert Kranz, Tommy Molsky, Gabe Davis. There are a bunch of key pieces in the bullpen who all have kind of taken that next step and have thrown the ball really well. And there is a lot of depth and not a lot of weak links on this Oklahoma State pitching staff. And Ryan Uhr, who just returned, I believe it was this weekend after missing all of 2023 with Tommy John surgery, he gives them another weapon, a 6'8 lefty who's been up to 95, 96 with his fastball. And then hitting wise, they have key pieces and they have guys that I like. And obviously Carson Benge, Zach Earhart is the perfect like spark plug leadoff guy to have as your table setter. Freshman Colin Ritchie is going to be a really good one. Same with Avery Ortiz. But other guys like Colin Bregman has been just okay this year. Tyler Wolfert, similarly. I think getting Nolan Schubert back, even though it comes with a ton of swing and miss, man, if he could just make contact on a somewhat more consistent basis and iron out his approach, his offensive ceiling and upside would be that much higher. But he gives you, like, he is such a imposing at bat for opposing pitchers, even with the swing and miss. Like, he can leave the yard at any time. It's double plus raw power. He's a legit big time middle of the order bat. So I think that there is plenty to be excited about in Stillwater, both with the pieces they have and also what they've done to this point. And this weekend against Oklahoma is the perfect opportunity to make a statement in a rivalry series at home, catch Oklahoma State limping a little bit, and, you know, thrust their way into the top two, top three, depending on how everything shakes out, maybe even top spot in the conference when all is said and done.
Yeah, this weekend, Oklahoma State hosts the Sooners. This is the final weekend series in Bedlam for the foreseeable future, as Oklahoma next year departs for the SEC. Josh Holiday has said that they're going to keep playing. They're going to play midweeks. I believe it's going to be a home and home midweek situation, kind of the Kentucky Louisville model, where each team hosts a game. I kind of wish they would adopt the Florida State model if they're insistent on midweeks and throw in a neutral site game, because, you know, for the longest time they used to play the weekend series on a neutral site, and they would pack out Tulsa or Oklahoma City, the minor league ballparks there. So kind of hope that maybe they can find a way to do that or go to a weekend series before conference play starts. You know, I saw Josh Holliday told some reporters that, you know, like Oklahoma has to get ready for 10 weeks of SEC baseball and the Pokes have to get ready for 10 weeks of Big 12 baseball. But, you know, Clemson and South Carolina, Miami and Florida, Georgia, Georgia Tech, like they've all figured it out. So I'll hold out a little bit of hope that eventually Oklahoma and Oklahoma State can get onto a weekend in this new setup. Nobody asked for my opinion. I mean, I guess you guys did by tuning into this podcast, but none of these coaches have asked for my opinion. So, but if you have, if you're curious, that would be my hope that they can find a way to do that. But anyway, all of that's to say that this weekend is a big opportunity for Oklahoma State, not just in terms of, you know, the rivalry aspect and this being the last weekend series for, again, the foreseeable future. But like Peter said, like they could walk out of here having made a big jump in the conference standings. They could really hurt Oklahoma if the Sooners take a third series loss in a row. Like that would be pretty tough on them. And, you know, the Pokes can take care of or build on some of the momentum that they've been able to accrue. So this is one of the biggest series of the weekend. I know neither of these teams are ranked, but for me, this is maybe the series I'm most excited about this weekend.
Yeah, 100% for me. There are others around the country, but I think like in the spirit of the Big 12 and giving the conference its dues, this, I mean, I might be most excited about this series outside of UNC, UVA, Alabama, Kentucky. There are a couple of other series between nationally ranked teams, but as far as intrigue goes, this one and Santa Barbara, UC Irvine are my top two.
Last weekend, Texas went to Kansas State. They won a series. I had thought that the winner, I said it here last week, that I thought the winner of that series would be ranked. And then I realized that Texas had lost a midweek game to Corpus Christi. And I said, well, maybe not. And maybe not came through on that. But the way in which Texas won that series, they lose the first game. LeBaron Johnson gets knocked out early. Kansas State scores a bunch of runs. Then Texas comes back. And the middle game of that series got really goofy. In that Texas won 21-11, Texas scored 14 runs in the final three innings to take that one. And then the finale was a little more normal, but Texas able to get it done on the road there. I thought that was a big deal. We talked about Kansas State last week as, you know, being a team that seemed like maybe they were starting to come into their own. They had started Big 12 play well and built some momentum. And then Texas comes through and, you know, reminds everyone that, first of all, they can really swing the bats. And second of all, I just thought it was, you know, after the way that they lost on Thursday night, they lose 14-6, and it really wasn't even that close. And LeBaron Johnson gets knocked out in the second inning. For them to take that, flush it, and come back and win the series in the manner that they did, I was impressed by the fortitude the Longhorns showed.
Yeah, that was huge. And they've continued to build some real momentum here. After their series loss a few weeks ago against Washington, they've won their last two series. They have a pretty favorable stretch of schedule coming up here, leading up into a pretty big series with TCU in a couple weekends. They're an offensive heavy team. They, like you said, and like they showed last weekend, they can really swing it. 1-9, almost everyone can hurt you, but especially Jared Thomas and Peyton Powell up at the top are quite the dynamic duo. The resurgence of Jalen Flores has been remarkable to see and really awesome to see. Guys like Max Bellew, who didn't play a whole lot as a freshman, he's now emerged as a legitimate left-handed power bat in that lineup. Kimball Schessler, similarly. And then even freshman Will Gasparino, I know he's, you know, there are some swing and miss issues and he's been in a little bit of a rut lately, but he's also shown pretty loud flashes. And then on the mound, it starts with LeBaron Johnson, and then after that, it's kind of everyone else. Max Grubb, sophomore right-hander, has thrown the ball well. Same with Chase Lummis, Andre Duplantier. I think that their bullpen is a lot more imposing right now than their rotation is. They have some solid depth pieces in the back end of the bullpen, but with the Longhorns right now, I'm kind of unsure of their upside long term. I think that they'd be able to hit with anyone or almost anyone, and I think that they have a pretty good chance here in the next couple of weeks to play their way back into a top 25 ranking. But come tournament time, I just wonder a little bit about the pitching and if it might lead to an early exit. But they certainly, like, they are certainly a team to be reckoned with right now.
I think two things are critical for them in the second half and then into the tournament. And one is getting LeBaron Johnson right, because this was not the first time he has not been at his best and got knocked out early. And, you know, if they get him back to where he was in the second half of last year when he was pitching like one of the better pitchers in the country, if they can get that back, put a rotation together of him, Ace Whitehead, and Max Grubb, that's not world beating, but I think that's solid enough, particularly with some of the options they have in the bullpen and the fact that they are going to score runs. And then secondly, I would say the draw is going to matter, assuming that they don't host. If they host, like, obviously everything gets easier, but, you know, right now, you know, DBU and A&M certainly look like they're on track to host regionals. DBU's not, they're not secure in that just by virtue of what conference they play in and what a bad weekend can mean for their RPI. But if DBU and A&M both host, like Texas, again, if they're not hosting, like, the likelihood of them going to one of those two spots is pretty good. And avoiding A&M is certainly something you want to be doing right now. And, you know, so we would see what the draw looked like. And again, if they get sent to College Station, just with the way A&M is playing right now, like, that just doesn't seem like a good setup for anyone. But there's a long way to go. And, you know, for me, this is some big hot take here. The season for Texas might hinge on the preseason Big 12 pitcher of the year getting back to being that kind of pitcher. If they get that back, if they can locate that in the second half of the season, then Texas becomes a lot scarier. K-State this weekend, another tough weekend. They go to UCF. UCF just 6-6 in the league, but they are, like, they have the top 10 RPI. Like, they have the elite RPI. Nobody else in the conference has that. And yes, they're 6-6, but if you take away the fact that they got swept by Oklahoma at the start of March, since then they've run off series wins against Oklahoma State, Kansas, and Texas Tech. Another chance this weekend. And if they win this one, maybe I'll start taking them a little more seriously as a host potential. Like, I'm not dismissing them, but there also is a reason why I didn't plug UCF in as a host. I don't know what I'm looking for UCF to prove themselves to me, but they've certainly piled up some strong wins here in the first half of the season.
Without a doubt. And I think they're very much for real. And on top of the quality series wins they have to its resume, they have a trio of midweek wins over in-state rivals and at Miami, at Florida Atlantic, who's off to a solid start, and then at number 4 Florida. Make of that one what you will. Florida is still the most perplexing team in college baseball, but that will never not be a quality win. I think it's a very well-rounded team. They have a few big bats on offense, but it's their pitching that I'm probably most excited about and is the biggest strength of the team right now. And again, similar to Texas, they have three legit weapons in their bullpen that they have used to really put the nail in coffins of games to this point, with Chris Sosnowski, Kyle Kramer, and Kramer and Santala especially. And then they've also got a couple of guys in the rotation that have thrown the ball well. So it's like, they're a very, very good team. There is not one super prospecty guy that jumps off the page. But the best way to sum them up, and it's going to sound simple, is they're just a really good baseball team. Like, they will remain competitive in every game that they play, I guess outside of those two against Oklahoma in early March. But they got Oklahoma, so make of that one what you will. But an impressive bounce back to that series loss with a series win against Oklahoma State. A series win most recently over Texas Tech. Like, even just in talking through what they've done so far and talking through the pieces, I know that there's no real star power here, but man, it is a very good ball club. And I think that as time goes on here, and this weekend's a huge one for them against Kansas State, I think that they're right there when it comes to the top 25, and like you alluded to, even playing its way into a hosting spot.
West Virginia, you mentioned them beating Oklahoma, losing to Oklahoma State last weekend. They've kind of treaded water to this point. Their team, obviously, I believed in a lot coming into this year, had them as my Omaha sleeper. They have been without J.J. Weatherholt pretty much all season. That, I believe, is going to change this weekend, and he's going to come back in time for them to visit Kansas. That is potentially like the biggest possible. That's it. If J.J. Weatherholt comes back and looks like he did last year when he was the Big 12 Player of the Year, I believe that West Virginia, it can absolutely take off here. I don't know that that means like they would host or anything, but I have continued to put them in the field of 64 in part because when they get Weatherholt back, they're a different team. Texas Tech, a team that we traditionally are used to seeing near the top of the conference, they've scuffled. Their RPI is not in a great spot. They have some things later in the season that are going to help that RPI, but they are also going to have to start winning more Big 12 games if they're going to be able to take advantage of that kind of stuff. And Kansas has not made regionals in a decade. This is the second year under Dan Fitzgerald. They are 7-5 right now in Big 12 play, a long way to go, but they're moving in a very intriguing direction in terms of regionals. So Peter, take any of that, none of that, whatever. That's what I got on the Big 12.
Yeah, I echo almost all those sentiments. I think in starting with West Virginia, obviously getting J.J. Weatherholt back, and if J.J. Weatherholt plays like J.J. Weatherholt, which to those unfamiliar, I think if you're listening to this, you're probably pretty familiar, but he will look like one of the best players in the country. He is one of the best players in the country, but he will make that kind of impact and give this offense just an immeasurable boost. And I think they need it here a little bit. They've got a couple of threatening bats, but they're not really driving the baseball. They don't swing it all that well as a team. I think, again, which is interesting given how the Big 12 has looked in years past, this is a team again where even though it's more modest than some of the others that we've brought up, their pitching is probably its strong suit. That rotation, and they've recently started to plug in Derek Clark on Sundays. He's a undersized 5'9" lefty who is just the definition of an innings eater. He's gone the distance in both two weekends ago against Oklahoma and last weekend against Oklahoma State. That is a great guy to have going for you on Sundays when you need in a decisive third game. And then also just in general, Aiden Major has big time stuff, and he's a legit Friday guy for him. And then it's about kind of just figuring it out in the middle. They've gone with Tyler Switalski to this point. They've plugged in a couple of other guys. The bullpen has one really nice piece who's a lot better than the back of the baseball card might suggest, and it's David Hageman. He's probably a top 4 to 7 round draft guy, top 5 to 8 round draft guy. So there are pieces here, but like you said, J.J. Weatherholt is going to be the guy that takes this team to the next level if anyone is able to. And then similarly with Kansas, we had alluded to them a little bit last year when they were playing reasonably well. They had a competitive first year under Coach Fitzgerald. They've taken yet another positive step forward this year. I know you had them today as your last team in. And again, there are pieces to like both this year and then also beyond. And I'm kind of referring here to Friday starter Dominic Vogel, who's a true freshman, earned the Friday job coming out of fall practice, has excelled in the role to the tune of a sub-2 ERA with 33 strikeouts, holding opponents to a sub-200 batting average. offense, it's Jake English and Cody Shojinaga leading the charge. It's again, it's a team that's going to remain competitive in all of its series. And I think in talking through the Big 12, and obviously this weekend, like, it lines up well where there are intriguing matchups between some of the teams in the top half of the conference, top four in the conference even. But going forward, every series is going to mean a lot to really every team. And I think that's what makes it so much fun. And then with the Red Raiders, I'm with you completely on them. I think that they've got to kind of right the ship here soon.
I lied. One more quick one in this conference is that TCU, we've been hard on them. They were a top 10 team coming into the season. They started 13-0. They lost their first three Big 12 series. There's a reason why we've spent a fair amount of time talking about what's wrong with TCU. They did go out and they got a much needed sweep of Houston last weekend. I'd called that series a must win. They went out, they did it. So good job by TCU to do that. Still a ways to go to get back to where they want to be, but that at least can be the start of something, perhaps. So there's the Big 12. It is one of the conferences to watch down the stretch. Absolutely. Like Peter said, the matchups this week are favorable, but it's going to feel that way much of the season, I think, because unless some teams are able to start separating, it's just going to feel like everything's really condensed and really interesting week after week. So, you know, definitely a conference to watch this weekend and going forward. All right, we're going to talk about some other things around the country. Going to talk some ACC and SEC, particularly with UNC here in a second. But first, check this out. All right, Peter, there were some loud results last weekend, but one of the bigger ones was UNC going into Winston-Salem and sweeping aside Wake Forest. UNC became the first team this year to beat Chase Burns. They did that on Friday, and they homered four times off of Chase Burns and never stopped homering. They hit 14 home runs in the series. I had been skeptical, I guess, of what UNC was going to be able to accomplish because I wondered about their starting rotation. They're starting a couple freshmen in there, and, you know, just what is that going to look like all season long? Well, it's going to look a lot better if they keep hitting the way they are. This is the best UNC offense, I think. Like, I maybe need to spend a little more time on this, but it looks like the best UNC offense in a decade. And, you know, it just runs really deep. You've got all kinds of guys that can hit home runs. You've got some guys that can run. It just getting 27 outs against the Tar Heels this year is going to be really hard. And that's what they did to Wake Forest. They just hit all weekend long. And UNC with the big statement, their RPI is in the top five, and it's going to be sticky there. They're undefeated at home this season. Like, I have a lot of great things to say about UNC right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's going really, really well right now in Chapel Hill. And they, for a team that's 25-4, it feels like just now, like after this weekend, they've kind of woken everyone up to just how good they are. And it obviously going to Winston-Salem and sweeping Wake Forest in that fashion will do that to you. But like you said, the offense is just, it reminds me of Virginia Tech in the ACC, and it reminds me of obviously other teams around the country. But like you said, like, they just wear opposing pitchers down throughout the course of the game. And like, and they'll also jump on you quick. It is not a slow death by a thousand paper cuts type deal when playing the Tar Heels. But they are just a relentless, relentless group. Like, Casey Cook has tapped into some newfound power. Freshman Gavin Gallagher has emerged as a legit piece for him. Alberto Ozuna he's always had big time power. Now he's hitting a little bit more. Georgia transfer Parks Harbury most notably had that three home run game last weekend. And then you sprinkle in these supplemental pieces. Like,
well, and you haven't even mentioned Honeycutt.
I was going to leave him as the cherry on top.
Oh, okay. I was like, are you going to say Vance Honeycutt's a supplemental piece?
I'll stick to my little script here that I was going to go on. You have like nice supplemental pieces like Colby Wilkerson, Alex Madera, Anthony D'Onofrio, guys that move the baseball, can run a little bit, and then the cherry on top to all of this is you have a bona fide star center fielder in Vance Honeycutt, who, on top of being an extremely high level defender, and I know that he has his warts at the plate, and that's a whole separate discussion when talking about the draft, but when just looking at him as a college performer and college player, like, you have a guy that has plus power, it's an extremely athletic operation in the box, he can run, he can hurt you in so many different ways, and there is not, when you look at this team 1 through 9, there is not one guy that you can circle or underline and say, hey, okay, you know, we get a little bit of a break here. Like, there is no such hitter in that lineup. And on the mound, like, we talked about it last week when we were getting into this Carolina and Wake Forest series, or just talking about Carolina a little bit in general. They were dealt a pretty big blow before the season when Jake Knapp got hurt and went down with Tommy John surgery. Like, that was a huge, huge blow to a rotation that didn't look like it had a whole lot of depth. It certainly didn't have a whole lot of returning depth, and it only added to the vagueness going into the year. Like, a big what if was, what if these freshmen didn't really perform? Like, you'd be looking at a lot different of a team. But credit to Jason DeCaro, who is still only 17 years old. Folger Bose, similarly, he's not 17, but he's thrown the ball well. And then Shea Sprague, he was a guy that I had circled this offseason as kind of an under-the-radar transfer get. Pitchability lefty, just a steady presence on the mound. He's a strike thrower. He's done exactly what he's needed to in that Sunday starter role. And, like, Matthew Mathis right now in the bullpen, not only, like, he's got a 2.6 ERA with 29 Ks to 27 walks, he got a good breaking ball, fastball up to 95, but he's got a nation leading 11 wins right now, which I just find to be fascinating. Like, I think that's a pretty cool nugget. But there is
the thing about the way UNC has gone about it, like, Mathis is I feel like representative of this. Like, Scott Forbes is just really good at managing a bullpen, you know, and he does a great job of finding the right pieces. And that's been a UNC hallmark throughout Forbes's time there, either as pitching coach or now as the head coach. And I guess I should not have worried so much about the rotation. I should have just trusted that UNC would figure some things out and, you know, approach things backwards if they needed to. But the thing that I just could not have anticipated is, Peter, they have the best outfield in the country. You know, when you look at Honeycutt, Cook, and D'Onofrio, I mean, it's not like all those dudes hit, you know, all three of, like, they have combined, 25 homers between the three of them. They have guys that can run, they defend really well out there. I mean, it's an impressive group, and that lineup, like, to me, that's been a real difference maker for them, because I did not anticipate UNC rolling out their best lineup in this lawn. So, I mean, like I said, this is a team that can compete at the top of the ACC, you can't put it in ink that they're hosting, but it would really require some things to really go sideways on UNC if there's not going to be baseball at Boschmer Stadium this June. On the flip side, Peter, Wake Forest. They're now 4-8 in the ACC, and things are starting to get a little dicier. Certainly hosting becomes all the more complicated. Just when we're this far in, you can start just counting up losses and thinking, like, okay, what's it going to take now? And, you know, ACC teams don't host with less than 16 wins, and really you might want to get to 17. And so that, you know, you're starting to say, like, even if Wake Forest were to host, they'd have to go like 13-5 the rest of the way. And, like, that feels like a thing that they're not going to be able to do. Nick Kurtz is back, but, you know, I don't really worry about them making the tournament yet. It's too early for that, but they could not really afford to have gotten swept this weekend, and that's what happened.
Yeah, and one, I went on a whole tangent about UNC. I had a Wi-Fi issue, so I don't know how
you
much
cut out after being very impressed about the 11 wins that Matthews has.
Okay, I'm glad I got.
I think we got most of it.
Okay, good. I finished it out by saying they're playing like an Omaha team and have that upside. So I just wanted to echo that, which isn't something I don't think you disagree with. But on the flip side, with Wake, we've talked about them at length now. I know I've gone on my tangents about them. Like, free bases are just such a killer for them, and they just can, it continues to be an issue, both shoddy defense, and then also walks, hit by pitches, wild pitches on the mound. I think that there are some like lights at the end of the tunnel, or just positive signs in general. One, Cole Roland and Crawford Wade made their respective returns on Tuesday. In their midweek game, they each fired a scoreless inning. Nick Kurtz is also, like, he had a two-homer game on Sunday against Carolina. He homered again on Tuesday. We kind of have been talking about, and everyone has kind of thought it was only a matter of time before he got going and started swinging it a little bit better. If this is when he decides to do it and pick it up and kind of goes nuclear for the next month and a half to 2 months, like when it really matters, this Wake team and obviously their offense, but the team in general is going to look a lot different in the best way possible. I think that there are, you know, the lineup isn't as imposing as everyone once thought. And the pitching staff outside of Chase Burns is, you know, there's a lot to be desired. And I think that when people with Nick Kurtz, people are kind of waiting for that similar resurgence with Josh Hartle. Like, we keep waiting for that one outing where he goes, throws seven shutout innings, allows like four hits, strikes out 12. Looks like the Josh Hartle that of 2022 and especially 2023. So there are certainly some talented pieces on this club, and I haven't like totally entertained the thought of them missing the tournament yet. I don't think they will. They're certainly comfortably in the field right now, in contention to host still. But I still do question their overall upside. I think even with Kurtz able to get going, and Crawford Wade and Cole Roland coming back, like, is that going to be enough to completely right the ship? I still think it's a really solid and a really good team that no one is going to want to play at all in a regional or a super regional or in a postseason setting. I don't know about its ceiling right now.
Here's my biggest concern with Wake Forest going forward. It's now the schedule. Their ACC schedule was front loaded with home games. They've played three home series already. So they have six series left. Four of them are on the road. They're at Virginia Tech, at Boston College, at Notre Dame, and at NC State. A couple of those are really tough. A couple of those are much simpler, at least on paper, but you still would rather get Notre Dame and BC at home rather than having to go to Boston or to South Bend. Wake is 3-4 on the road this season as well, so this is not a team that either has played well on the road or has played much on the road. And then their home series are Florida State and Clemson. And yeah, if you have to play Florida State and Clemson, I would much rather play them at home. But I would also, if I was, you know, fighting an uphill battle, I would hope that they wouldn't have, I would hope I wouldn't have to play Florida State and Clemson in the final 6 weeks of the season. So the schedule is not favorable right now. And look, it's nothing Wake Forest can't handle if they start playing to their potential. But, you know, if we take Wake at face value right now, like, that schedule is, that's a lot. That's a lot for any team to handle.
Really tricky. And then you also kind of sprinkle in these tough midweeks with Coastal, UNCW, like the final series against NC State is not going to be an easy one. I don't know what NC State's going to look like at that point. But again, when you take Wake at face value right now, like, that is not going to be an easy one. So there is not a lot of favorability left on their schedule. So it's kind of put up or shut up time in Winston-Salem right now. But I will say the good news, like, they have the personnel to rise to the occasion. So I'm looking forward to see how they respond to this early, well, not really early season anymore. Looking forward to see how they respond to this adversity, how they punch back, and what they look like in their kind of final form with these pieces returning.
The other big ACC series last weekend was Virginia visiting Duke. Duke went out. They split the first two games. Duke finds a way to take the series finale. That one felt really important to me because, you know, if you're Duke, you know, you've been lauded all season long, but you've been lauded in large part because of what you did in the first 4 weeks of the season when you swept through that tournament at Coastal, and then you went to Winston-Salem and won a series. And almost all of that just looks a lot different now. Coastal has been up and down, still a ranked team that you beat on the road. So good job in terms of that. But Coastal's been up and down. Wake Forest has not looked like the number one team in the country that they were when Duke won that series. And Indiana, which was another big part of Duke's opening weekend at Coastal, Indiana has just fallen flat in the first half of the season. So, you know, I was kind of like, I wasn't really wondering about Duke, but, you know, if they had lost this weekend to Virginia, I would have wondered a little bit more about Duke. But Duke comes back, wins the finale, 7-4.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out, and when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
They also got Kyle Johnson back. He'd missed his last two starts. So if he can get back to being what he was in the first month of the season, that would really help the pitching staff. We talked about how much pressure they put on their bullpen. Getting Kyle Johnson back into the rotation could really help from that perspective as well.
Yeah, and if they had lost that series last weekend, I mean, they'd be sitting at under 500 in the ACC right now. The narrative would be a heck of a lot different. And instead, you get a huge marquee series win over a really good team. You get a big key piece like Kyle Johnson back, like you said, that's going to ease a lot of the stress on the bullpen. And you can kind of breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief right now in Durham. They have another tricky one coming up this weekend against Miami, who has done nothing but play teams really tough and even have taken a couple series from a few or a couple of high quality teams. But I think and it's a cold take now that they won a series over Virginia, but I'm less concerned about Duke right now than I was this time last week. I think just seeing them respond, the bullpen kind of figure things out, especially Charlie Bielenson. And the lineup, again, it's they've come back down to earth, obviously, since those first few weeks where I think they were leading the country in home runs. Some of the guys have leveled out some, but it's still a threatening lineup. There's still big-time depth on the mound, obviously, with Santucci, Andrew Healy, Kyle Johnson now on Sundays. Like, that's a really good trio of arms that they're going to be able to trot out there for the rest of the season and the postseason. And the depth of the bullpen is going to be continue to be talked about as one of the team's biggest strengths, if not its biggest strength. And I think that they do have the type of pitching to sustain like a really long-winded regional or a three-game super regional. And they've shown that the offense, they can go toe-to-toe and kind of swing it with anyone. And I still feel pretty confident in Duke. They have looked like world beaters at times, other times not so much. But I think when all is said and done, like I still think, you know, they have College World Series type upside. I think that, you know, that's how good of a club they are.
This weekend, like you mentioned, Duke gets Miami. They get that at home. That is very significant, as Miami has to, you know, is much harder to beat in Coral Gables. Virginia goes back home. They play North Carolina. Not having to play that in Chapel Hill is significant. Part of the reason why UNC had flown under the radar for a little bit is because they took two series losses. One of them was at Miami, and the other was in that split series against ECU. So this is a different kind of road test. Like, I don't want to diminish what UNC did last weekend at Wake Forest in any way, but, you know, they didn't leave the state of North Carolina. I assume they got a hotel. I'm not actually sure how UNC handles a trip to Winston-Salem. It's like kind of an awkward distance. But going to Virginia is a more typical road trip. You got to leave the state anyway. And so I'm curious to see. And Virginia has only lost twice at home this season, and one of those was a Chase Burns start. So that's a really big series. And it's also big, I feel like, for Virginia, because the rest of the way, I love that we're to a point in the season where I can always already like look at the rest of the schedule and say, well, things are starting to break their way, or not their way in Wake's case. But after this one, Virginia is at Louisville, home to Georgia Tech, home to BC, home to NC State, home to Virginia Tech. I don't know how, like, I think one of those is marked wrong on this. But regardless, like, the schedule lessens from here. And, you know, NC State and Virginia Tech at the end of the season will be tricky. But until then, Virginia has a nice little run of games, particularly if they can get some momentum this weekend and avoid back-to-back series losses.
Yeah, this would be a huge win for a lot of reasons. One, it would be over a really, really good North Carolina team. And two, like you said, they go into, I think, is probably as favorable a stretch of schedule as you can find, at least in this year's ACC. That final series with Virginia Tech is going to be a dandy, though. I'm already fired up for that one, even though it's a month plus away. But I think that this weekend there are going to be a lot of fireworks offensively. I think that it's going to be a struggle on both sides to keep the ball in the yard, both given UNC's offensive firepower and UVA's lack thereof on the mound. And I think also with UVA's offense, I think they can swing it with anyone in the country. They're bound to keep them in all three of these games. So I think it's going to be three really high scoring games. I'd give the advantage to UVA just with how well they play at home. But that UNC lineup is, I mean, if they can get into Virginia's bullpen quick, which I know that when you're looking for a strong point of this Virginia team, I think, like, or on the pitching staff at least, Colin McKay and Evan Blanco, like, they both have struggled at times so far this year, but I think that's a pretty solid 1-2 punch when they're both throwing the ball well. I think that's somewhat of a big if, but if they're both on, those are two guys who can go out and give you two quality starts and win you a series. And I think that an underrated development in the last 2 weeks has been Kevin Jaxel in the Sunday role. It's been his first two starts of the season. He's allowed, I believe, 3 earned runs across 10 innings pitched. Last weekend, he allowed 2 earned in 5 innings against Duke. And then the week before, I think it was just 1 earned in 5 innings against Pitt. But he's thrown the ball well on Sundays, which we mentioned that as a huge question mark for them and kind of what they were going to do on Sundays. He seems like the answer for now. The bullpen, Chase Hungate and Angelo Tanas are the two guys. Freshman Matt Augustine has also been, like, he's stepped up and established and cemented himself into a meaningful role. But I digress on the UVA pitching staff. I kind of give the advantage, though, to the Cavaliers with how well they play at home.
Yeah, I think this is just a tough one for the Tar Heels, just in terms of having to go to Charlottesville versus being in Chapel Hill. The UVA series that was marked around was they go to Boston College, but that means that they end the season with NC State and Virginia Tech back-to-back weekends at home. So that could be pretty significant for them. But yeah, if they can take care of home field advantage this week, this would be a potentially really significant series win for them. And, you know, UNC stunningly has not won the division in like a decade. And as, you know, you try and, like, you know, look at things, jockeying for position in terms of ACC tournament scenarios, like this weekend with UNC going to Virginia could be a really significant one in terms of that. It's a little early to think that way, but as you try and, like, sort through the ACC pecking order, be that for the ACC tournament or be that in terms of a host, potential host sites and potential top 8 seeds, like, this is a weekend that could have significant resonance into May. Let's take another quick break here, and then we'll be back to talk some SEC and hopefully some Big West baseball. So we'll be right back after this quick break. Having a second break in the podcast is tricky for me. I gotta work on that transition. But anyway, we welcome the additional advertisements. The SEC. It was a different weekend, I guess, so many of the games were Thursday through Saturday because of Easter. It feels like this stuff happened forever ago. I was in Arkansas, though. Arkansas swept LSU. And, you know, Peter, like, Arkansas is just an impressive team. Their pitching staff is incredible. Their lineup is not like an elite lineup, but it is quite deep and you have to put them away. They don't make anything easy for you. It doesn't feel like they swing and miss a lot. They're just going to really grind through things. Like, they're not, you know, we've seen some Arkansas teams in the past that just really are going to hit home runs all the time. This is not that team, but they take advantage of what you give them. And they've got some guys that can put the bat on the ball. And that was what carried the day for them. LSU was tight in all three of those games. They just weren't able to come through. And part of that was because Arkansas is the better bullpen. And part of that was because Arkansas did a good job of taking advantage of some things. And that's what Arkansas has done this year. And I don't know how much more we can say about Arkansas. It's a really good baseball team. And, you know, that pitching staff is phenomenal.
Yeah, they have the best pitching staff in the country. The lineup, like you said, it's not going to beat you with the long ball by any means, but there are a lot of intriguing bats in there, especially Vahava Aloy, Peyton Stovall. And like you said, it's just a damn good baseball team. Like, I've had my questions about their lineup. I still kind of do. But I mean, we're over halfway into the season now, and like they haven't really, other than that one Saturday game at Auburn, they haven't really needed to get into kind of a slugfest, so to speak. And I think that this pitching staff can, they can carry it all the way. They can carry this team all the way to Omaha, I think. And as a quick little aside, like at this point last year, it was pretty, we felt pretty confident in saying that LSU and Wake were clearly the top two teams in the country. It was going to be pretty difficult to touch them, and that they were two safe bets to get to Omaha. I think at this point, Arkansas is obviously the clear top team right now, but there is no one right now in college baseball that I'm looking at and saying like this team is unbeatable. Like it is so volatile week to week in the rankings, and you guys see it with how teams are shuffled around, with how many teams enter, re-enter, get dropped out. And I think it's going to make for a really fun tournament, but there is no team right now, even for as good as Arkansas is, that I am kind of like hanging my hat on as okay. They seem like a pretty sure bet to be playing for a national championship. Like I think we could go in so many different directions with
I mean, and like you have a really good team leading the ACC as well in Clemson, but like they also don't look unbeatable. Like we've talked a lot about how often they play in close games and how they need comebacks a fair amount. And, you know, neither one of those two teams, while they do look like a clear one and two right now, would I say like, oh, well, they're like far and away the best teams in the country. Like LSU hung tough in these games, and, you know, they don't get any, there's no medal for that. But the other thing about it is like Arkansas kind of helped them hang tough in these games, that if Arkansas was an offense that we have seen out of some previous Hog teams, they might have buried LSU, and instead they didn't. And, you know, credit to Arkansas for finding a way to win, and they're just built differently this year. And, you know, they can feel good about the team that they have and should feel good about the team that they have. But it also, like, I would struggle to call it a super complete team because the offense just is not on the same level as their pitching staff. And I'm not asking for them to have the best offense and the best pitching staff in the country, but it's not an offense that is going to, like, if the pitching staff has a bad day, I don't know what a shootout involving Arkansas looks like. And they haven't really had to, we haven't had to find that out yet too much, but the way that they lost the one SEC game that they've lost to this point is that, you know, Auburn put up 8 runs on them, and 8 runs for this offense against SEC pitching, I don't know how many times you're going to see them do that. Like they scored 7 on LSU twice, but like there's a difference between 7 and 8 and 9. And so if you can find a way to score on this pitching staff, and good luck with it, but like that's how you beat Arkansas this year.
Yeah. And a bad day for that pitching staff looks a heck of a lot different than a bad day for really every other pitching staff in the country. But like you said, if you can somehow hang 8 on them, you'll probably be in a pretty good position to win, like you would be probably in most of the other games. But with LSU last weekend, I didn't leave the weekend super unchanged about like where I stood on LSU. I was kind of hoping that they would take one game just from an optics standpoint. Like 3-6, I think, looks a heck of a lot different than 2-7 in the SEC. 21-8 would have looked like, there's just something a lot better about salvaging a series and getting swept. And I know it was to Arkansas. I was impressed with how competitive they remained in each of the 3 games. I even thought they could have won at least one, perhaps even 2. But then they go out on Monday and they lose 12-7 against Southern, which like we were already kind of tinkering with the idea of, you know, where to exactly slot LSU in our rankings, and that didn't exactly help their cause. And I think when, like, you look at their schedule coming up too, and it's kind of the reverse Virginia for at least for the next couple of weeks, because if they're looking to snap this rut of 3 consecutive SEC series losses, it's going to be hard to do it in the next 2 weeks, because they have Vanderbilt starting today through Saturday, and then they go to Lindsey Nelson Stadium next weekend to take on a Tennessee team that is that at times has looked, I'd say, as good as anyone in the country. So they're kind of staring down the barrel of a really big, like, 6-game stretch here. I don't know. Like things could really snowball on them. And I think that they're going to need to somehow win one of these series. I don't know which one it's going to be. I feel like it's like you're going to lean towards the home series, and especially with the home field advantage they get at the box, I feel like that's the safer bet to take. But the Tigers are in a really, really precarious spot right now. And in kind of analyzing the bones of this team, really outside of Tommy White and Hayden Travinsky, which has been the case all year, like, it is a thin, thin lineup. Jared Jones has a ton of power. He'll flash it in game. But in terms of guys who, like, are hitters and pure hitters, they really lack that. Steven Malam, freshman, he swung the bat well. Mac Bingham has come on as of late, which has provided a big boost. But outside of those two guys, it's been a struggle to get production from really anyone. And then it also doesn't help that outside of Luke Holman and Gage Jump, for the most part, it's also been kind of tough sledding on the pitching staff, both from a third starter standpoint and then also in the bullpen outside of maybe two arms. So it's like, I don't know. Everyone knew that this team would look a lot different than last year in Baton Rouge. I know that it's impossible to kind of come back from what they did last year, like the whole like arc of that team where they were the, by and large, the preseason number one. They live up to and exceed that entire, all of the hype. They have the number one and number two overall picks in the draft. Like, it was going to be impossible to like follow that up. But I think that no one saw this coming, which is a concerning start to SEC play for sure.
So I am writing about LSU right now. Like, if you read what I wrote about Wake Forest a few weeks ago, like, what's wrong with Wake Forest? I'm doing that for LSU right now. And I was on the fence about doing it coming out of the Arkansas series, because it was like, yeah, they lost their first three SEC series. This was the number two team in the country in the preseason. This isn't good. On the other hand, like, they did just get swept by the number one team in the country, and they played them pretty well. And then they lost on Monday night. And I was like, well, I guess we're definitely doing this now. And there's some things that I got wrong about LSU when I picked them to win the national championship, when I pushed to rank them number two in the country or higher in the preseason. And there are some things that just like haven't gone right, that like weren't, you know, you couldn't necessarily have forecast. The lineup is a real issue right now. They rank second to last in the SEC in conference play in hitting. Some of that's because they just played Arkansas, but like, that's not where LSU is supposed to be. Jay Johnson is one of the best offensive coaches in the country, and things just haven't clicked for them offensively. They booted some balls against Arkansas, which is part of the reason why they lost all three games. You know, a better defense, maybe they steal the game in there somewhere. But the defense hasn't really been like the massive concern that I think some people thought. Like, if you're going to poke LSU coming into the season, I think a lot of people were pointing to the defense. It hasn't really been the defense that's been the biggest issue. The rotation, Thatcher Hurd was the opening day starter. He, you know, started game three of the College World Series finals last year against Florida. He has not been good, Thatcher Hurd. But like, that's not even really the issue, because Luke Holman and Gage Jump have mostly been pretty good, and a lot of teams have third starter issues. Like, to me, like, right now, the biggest issue is a combination of the lineup lacking depth and the bullpen lacking depth. And I thought this was the deepest roster in the country, one through whatever you wanted that number to be coming into the season. And the bullpen just has not come together in that way. They've dealt with some injuries, but you know, they've also just dealt with some guys not stepping up and performing the way that was expected. And the same can be said about the lineup. And the biggest, like, the issues are the issues. Here's the cold hard fact, though. Like, they're 2-7 in the SEC. to host in the SEC, like sometimes you can host at 15-15, but to get to 15-15, even LSU has to go 13-8 the rest of the way. Doable, not out of the question, doable, but not like that's bare minimum to get to a threshold to host. Really, they've got to be targeting going 14-7 at least. And I don't know that I have great confidence in this team flipping it around, considering the schedule. Like Peter did a good job outlining like what they have in front of them, and it's not easy. If your threshold is just like, can they make the tournament? Because, you know, Ole Miss and Mississippi State didn't make the tournament the last 2 years after winning the national title. Things are much more optimistic on that front. The selection committee gives SEC teams a fair amount of leeway, and you know, if LSU gets to 14-16, they'll be in. If they get to 13-17, they might get in. Like that, it becomes a little more 50-50 if you only get to 13 SEC wins. All of that's very doable, but this is not like I'm just like, can they get in? Like talking about it that way, like that's not what anybody in Baton Rouge ever wants to talk about, and certainly not what anybody thought they were going to be talking about this year. It's hard to say any series is a must win in April, but I called some series in March must win. So yeah, this weekend pretty much is a must win for LSU, especially as it pertains to playing onto the host line, because going to Tennessee is really tough. Vanderbilt has looked really good at home this season and not so good away from home. Ask South Carolina about that. So if you can take advantage of being back at home, where LSU has played better this year, like two of the, it also is true that they've gone to Starkville and to Fayetteville, two very difficult places to play, and went 1-5. Like a lot of teams around the country are going to go 1-5 if you do that. Like, would it be a lot better if they'd gone 2-4 or 3-3 or 4-2? Like, yeah, obviously, but the schedule has been difficult to this point, but it's also the SEC. Things are always going to be hard. If LSU can get the series win this weekend, just get through the situation in Knoxville, whatever that is, like win one game, do your best to get out of there with a win. Tennessee's not unbeatable. They go to Missouri, they're home to Auburn, they're home to A&M, they go to Bama, they're home to Ole Miss. The second half of the season, SEC-wise, is undoubtedly easier from a schedule standpoint. But you got to get there, and you got to get there with a good mindset. And that is also a concern at this point, because you lost to Southern, and you know, just like, what has that done to you mentally? And you know, like, they are just where the mentality of this team is going forward. Like, that is now a crucial situation. And Peter and I, like, we talked about it on the podcast coming into the season about like this crazy theory I have that one day, like, I'll get into a place where I actually like feel good enough to write about it. But the reason why, in my mind, why Ole Miss and Mississippi State missed the tournament following the season isn't that like they had to replace Tanner Allen and Tim Elko and Dylan DeLucia, like production, but because they had to replace their mentality and their leadership, and they weren't able to do it. And, you know, Dylan Cruz, Paul Skeens, Cade Beloso, like all of these dudes were really, really good as baseball players. But the other part of it is they were older, they'd been through some stuff, and they weren't going to let their teams lose. And now this is the case at Wake. This is the case at LSU. Who is going to step up when you're facing the most adversity you've faced in the last couple years and say, we've got this, we can dig ourselves out of it, it's not gone too far yet? Because it hasn't. Everything is still on the table for both of those teams. Like, I'm saying, like, I don't think they're going to host, but like, they could totally flip a switch and host from where they are right now. Clemson did that a year ago. Like, there are plenty of examples in college baseball history of teams doing that, but you have to be like strong enough as a team to do it. And we're going to find out if either one or both of those teams is.
Yeah, I think that is such a really, really good point you made about the leadership, because I think that often gets overlooked, and you summed it up perfectly. But it is it's seriously gut check time right now in Baton Rouge, and absolutely time for someone to kind of step up in that locker room and take the reins. Like, I have thoughts on who though that guy and those guys could be. And so I'm curious to see how they come out and look this weekend, because it is, they need a big response after both last weekend and Monday.
The other big series this weekend is Alabama visiting Kentucky. Kentucky is in first place in the SEC East. I mean, Wildcats were not a team that we spent hardly any time talking about, but here they are, 8-1. And like, yeah, let's just be honest with ourselves right now. They've played an easy SEC schedule. They hosted Georgia, they went to Missouri, and they went to Ole Miss. Those three teams are probably in the bottom half of the SEC. Like, Georgia has been a great story. Charlie Condon's amazing. Georgia also doesn't play that well on the road from what we've seen to this point. And, you know, Kentucky did get that one at home. But all of that being said, those wins count all the same. And Kentucky is 24-4. And this weekend, they host Alabama in what looks to be their biggest test yet. I mean, this is the Kentucky that, like, you kind of would have expected, just the best version of them. Like, they're not, you know, they make life difficult for you on offense. They're not the power hitting team in the SEC. They pitch well, they defend well, they make you beat them. And to this point, nobody's really been able to do it. They go out, they get a sweep in Swayze. They had never done that. Kentucky has been playing Ole Miss in baseball from, like, I think more than 100 years, but certainly about a century's worth of baseball. They'd never done that before. And you just, at some point, you have to give it up for them. And hey, they're going to be in the hosting race all year. If you enjoyed the Kentucky, should Kentucky be a host last year? Like, I can't promise you that it's going to play out in the exact same way where they got off to a great SEC start and they fade down the stretch. But like, if you enjoyed that discussion point last year, like, boy, do I have good news for you, because it's back. It's back for 2024.
Yeah, no, you hit the nail on the head with them. Have they had the hardest schedule in the country to this point? No. But wins are wins, and stringing together wins in baseball is extremely hard to do, and they've done exactly that. And that's not to say they haven't beaten good teams. They have a sweep of Georgia. They have a road series sweep, a resounding one at that, last weekend against Ole Miss. I think this weekend, though, is obviously its toughest and biggest test to date, and I think going to be a really good barometer to see just how good they are. It's a team that I think is built on its pitching. Its pitching is its biggest strength. They do have some pieces in that lineup who can swing it well and drive the ball around the yard. Nolan McCarthy had a breakout weekend last weekend. Same with James McCoy. Specifically between Friday and Saturday, or Saturday and Sunday's game 2 and 3, where he went, I think, 7 for 8. Nick Lopez and Emelian Petrie are two solid guys at the top of the order, but they're going to have their hands full all weekend, both with Bama's pitching staff and then also Kentucky's pitching staff, especially its rotation, which is actually, they've fared really well to this point, but they're going to have their hands full with Alabama's lineup. I give the advantage to the Tide, but like you said, being at home this year is a cheat code. Granted, Kentucky's splits are going to look pretty darn good given they're 24-4, but they are 13-2 at Kentucky Proud Park, which is where they get the Tide. So I lean Tide here, but I do think it's going to be a really competitive and well-played series.
You know, I lean Kentucky, being that they're at home. Alabama has not been as good away from home, but like, this is another opportunity for them to prove themselves away from home. Kentucky right now, the only teams that have more wins than them, just raw wins, A&M, Clemson, and UNC. I mean, like, it's good company to keep. Alabama 2-4 in true road games this year. It looks better if you include neutral site, but you know, they got swept at Georgia. They kind of need something out of this weekend, I feel like, to prove that they can play on the road. They'll have other opportunities later. They go to both Mississippi schools and Auburn in the second half of the year, but this would be a nice chance for them to come out and say, like, hey, we can win on the road. It's not just we have to be at home to do it. And, you know, Alabama, it's best, like, they beat Tennessee at home, they beat South Carolina at home. Like, they can certainly play with you. But I Ben Hess hasn't been like the number one starter that we kind of expected. If he can turn in a really good start this weekend, like, because I feel like the advantage is on the mound, or Kentucky's biggest advantage is on the mound. If Alabama can thwart some of that, and that would start with Ben Hess, that to me is how they win this weekend.
Yeah, no, 100%. They need a, I think if they can get a tone setting start from Ben Hess, in like Friday night, Ben Hess to show up, I think that, they're going to be able to build off that and take the series. So I am with you that he is going to be the X factor for him.
I am not going to wade into this. We have spent enough time on this so far this season, but I do just want to note that Florida somehow managed to wrangle a series win against Mississippi State last week in the most Florida 2024 way possible. Well, we learned exactly nothing about Florida, but Florida did, as we, I believe we mentioned that they were going to on the podcast last week, they put Brandon Neely in the rotation. So they shook some things up. They win a series. I'm not concerned about Mississippi State getting walked off twice, because that's how their two losses happened. I thought that was a pretty good weekend on the road for the Bulldogs. And this week they're back at home against Georgia. And again, it's an opportunity for Georgia to go on the road and prove something. But it's also, I feel like Mississippi State needs to come home and say, like, okay, like we moved past, like, those were hard losses in Gainesville, but we're moving past it, and we're back where we need to be.
Yeah. I leave unchanged. My opinion left this weekend unchanged on Mississippi State. They were competitive. They had two really tough losses. And like you said, if they come back and pick up a series win over the Dogs, over the Georgia Bulldogs, I'm going to feel just as confident about them. So I think it's pretty important though, to respond, and just kind of not let this snowball on you, because then you've got a rivalry series at Ole Miss before, a series against Auburn, which I know that there are no real easy weekends in the SEC, but Auburn's off to a rough start, but
this is a stretch they need to take advantage of.
Yeah. If Mississippi State is for real, they are leaving this stretch with two series wins, in my mind. So,
and they're also like, they took a bad loss on Tuesday. They lost to Central Arkansas 7-6.
Right.
The bases loaded in the ninth inning with Dakota Jordan and Hunter Hines at the plate. Like, they needed a furious comeback in that inning just to get to that point. But that one, I'm sure, did not feel good.
No, not at all. So yeah, this weekend's important for a lot of reasons. And then, like you said, Florida's Florida. They remain a perplexing and confusing team to figure out. And I think the one point I wanted to hit on, at least coming into this podcast, was people, we get, at least I see it on Twitter all the time and on Instagram, people complain about Florida and why they're ranked where they're ranked, and, you know, all this stuff. Like, they win when it matters. They have so many confusing, head scratching losses in midweek games, some of which to lesser opponents. They typically win their weekend series 2-1 as opposed to sweeping. So that also has the losses pile up. But like, you can't drop a team for winning an SEC series and really winning a series in general. And the Gators have just found ways to win series. Yes, they're really confusing to figure out. There are absolutely holes on the roster, but you can't penalize a team for winning a conference series, especially in the SEC. So until they drop one, they're going to remain right there.
Let's go out west to the Big West. UC Irvine, UC Santa Barbara. It's not quite first versus second in the standings, but it is certainly what we think the two best teams in the Big West are. Both teams are ranked going into this weekend. You have the best lineup by far in UC Irvine, and you have, I don't know if they're clearly the best pitching staff, but certainly one of the best pitching staffs out there. And, you know, so great contrast of styles. Games happening in Irvine. I'm all in on Irvine, so obviously I'm going to Irvine this weekend, but I am very interested to see. And I also would add that just from a Big West, like, how many bids is the Big West going to be able to sustain standpoint? Like, this is a, you know, they need these two teams to do it. And if Irvine wants to host, I think it has to win this weekend. It has pushed into the top 20 in RPI. I've seen too many Big West teams fade down the stretch in RPI, though, to like get excited about that. But this is their best RPI opportunity, and they absolutely have to take advantage of it.
Yeah, this is the perfect weekend here for the Anteaters to make a serious statement. And UC Santa Barbara, it's my Omaha sleeper team. I'm still pretty bullish on the Gauchos. Again, it's a team that's built on its pitching staff. They have a bevy of arms that I'm a real big fan of. But for the Anteaters, like you said, this is like they really, really need this one for their hosting resume. Like looking through their schedule that remains, this is it when it comes to kind of adding that like marquee series win if it wants to host. And they're 22-3 right now. They are, again, they're a very, very well-rounded team. They throw the ball well. Nick Pinto has been such a steady presence on Friday nights. Anthony Martinez has really come on as of late and swung the bat really well. They've got a bunch of bullpen arms who are reliable. It is a very difficult team to beat. And I think that in looking at this weekend with Santa Barbara and looking at who Irvine has played to this point, they've got a nice 5-2 win over UCLA. UCLA is, I think, a below average team this year. So I think when it comes to a litmus test and a barometer for where they stack up, this weekend is a perfect test to see kind of just how good they are. And I love that Saturday's game, which starts at 8:30 Eastern, is on ESPN2 because this series deserves a lot of eyes on it.
Yeah, shout out ESPN for that choice. It is a great opportunity for the league. The craziest thing is, and you know, take RPI for what it's worth. By RPI, the best team that Irvine has beaten this season is San Diego, the Toreros. They're 44. They got them on Friday night at the Dodger Stadium Classic. The second best team is UC Davis. Now, UC Davis is a lot better this year. They're not necessarily like the cellar dweller Big West team that they've been for the past several seasons. Shouts to Tommy Nicholson for getting them turned around. But, you know, there are good teams that Irvine has played this year, but this is potentially just a different kind of opponent. You know, they, like I said, they need this. I really believe in them. You know, Nick Pinto on Friday night and Anthony Martinez and Woody Hayden and Kendall and, you know, all those guys, like this is their chance to like stand up and say, yeah, we are that good. And, you know, I'm really interested in this series.
Yeah, and forgot to even a little shout out to Joe Yama, who is one of the more fun players to watch on the team. I know he's kind of been quiet when it comes to a stat line, but Caden Kendall off to a blazing start. Yeah, it's just going to – I will be tuned in to all three. I'll watch 27 outs of all three of these games this weekend. I'm very juiced for this series.
Last thing before we get out of here was the very stunning upset that USC pulled last week against Oregon State. They won both games that they played. Game three was rained out. They won on Thursday night 2-1, and then they blew them out on Friday night, did the Trojans. And I was impressed, first of all, just A, that the Trojans went out and won a series against Oregon State, and B, the way they did it. Oregon State hadn't been held to fewer than two runs in, I think, 2 years. And then USC went out and put up a whole bunch of runs, which has been a problem for USC this season. It's just hitting, period. So for them to go out and win in both of those ways, like, it's not over for USC. They're still just 11-16. They have a ton of RPI work to do. But if you can go out and win back-to-back games against Oregon State, nothing is impossible in the Pac-12. Every other team, like, they can beat any team that they face if they can do that. It's just a matter of, you know, can they string all the wins together? But to me, that was, I don't think it's too little too late from USC by any means, but it has to just be the start of something rather than some sort of coming out party, because they still have a ton of work to do just to even get back to 500. Meanwhile, Oregon State, the injuries are piling up, and this weekend, I think they really felt it. They're missing three starters from their opening day lineup in terms of offense. And, you know, I think you saw it. They scored like five runs at USC. And yeah, USC can pitch, but it was it can't all be on Bazana. And it was a little too much all on Bazana this weekend.
Yeah, and with last weekend, I think it's more like I want to give credit to USC than I am concerned about Oregon State. Like, optically, it doesn't look good at all, but every team, by and large, I guess other than Arkansas, has had a bad weekend, a bad couple of games to this point. I think they'll flush it and keep rolling. But you're right. I think that the injury issues rear its ugly head a little bit. I think the key for them is just to get back and get right and get healthy before, you know, things really ramp up in May and into June. I think that's priority number one as they head into the tournament, is to just get to 100% healthy, because when they are at full strength, they at times will look like the best team in the country. But with USC, like you said, it can't be an anomaly. Like, it can't be a shooting star where it's just they have this weekend and then they kind of go back into their cave and, you know, fade away as the season winds down here in a little bit. So if there was any time to kind of build off a spark of momentum, it's now. So we'll see how they fare.
Speaking of sparks of momentum, the last thing I have before we get out of here is Arizona. As I was putting together the field of 64, I put in Arizona as one of the last teams in. They'd been off my radar for a little bit, but they swept UCLA, which this year is no great shakes necessarily. Arizona is up to 7-5 in the pack. Their RPI is 61. They have a really strong schedule. It's been up and down, obviously. You know, they're 7-5, 14-13 overall. That's the definition of up and down, I suppose. But the Wildcats are, you know, the team that beat Northeastern on opening weekend, and we all said, huh, like, they continue to, as I was evaluating the Pac-12 for ahead of this week's projection, like, that was the team that I was most intrigued by and surprised by. And so I'm just going to say, look out for the Cats going forward. Arizona State also, you know, kind of right there, surprisingly. We've talked about Utah being the surprise team, and Oregon is actually in first place, and those two teams are deserving of it. But it's, you know, we've been talking about, like, could Cal put it together, and Cal looks like it's not putting it together. But the Arizona schools look like they might be emerging, bubbling up. Somebody in the Pac-12 is going to do what we said, and the Arizona schools look like they might have what it takes to make things interesting.
Yeah, I kind of lean Cats, but in terms of if I had to pick one of the two to sneak,
yeah, I would pick not the team that got swept at Washington State. That's an issue. But yeah, they also did beat Arizona, so, you know, who knows?
That's true. I still lean Cats. I think that they are a little bit of a dangerous club, and that opening weekend proved to be somewhat of a sign of things to come. So they are now, in thanks to recent performance, a mighty intriguing team out west.
All right, so that's a podcast. A lot to follow this weekend, so make sure you are checking us out on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Peter is at Peter G. Flaherty. And over on the website, that's baseballamerica.com, where you can see those tournament projections, which I've referenced probably 20 times today. Welcome to that time of year, folks. You know, we've got a lot of draft stuff, minor league opening day, AAA opened last week, everybody else opens this weekend. So if you're into baseball at the professional level, it's a great time to check everything out over at baseballamerica.com as well. We'll be back here next week for another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. So make sure you are subscribed on your favorite podcasting app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. So until then, enjoy another jam-packed weekend of baseball, college, professional, big leagues, whatever you want. And we'll be back here to talk to you next week. So for Peter, I'm Teddy. Have a great one.